Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
So I'd like to welcome everybody back to the podcast with me again this week. I have to make sure that I give him his necessary honoraries, the Right Honourable Doug LaFollette, Mr. Secretary of State of Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us from your vacation today, sir.
Not me a vacation. I'm just here to help my brother on a couple projects.
Okay, my apologies. And, of course, my long friend, also the Right Honourable J. David Markham. Hello, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cameron. How are you and Doug doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So, David, you have a little segment you'd like to introduce into the show this week. Why don't you go for it?
Oh, okay. Well, I sort of had in mind in the future what we might do is do this at the end of the show. But for now, in fact, let me quickly quit that program so that we don't hear that.
I just think if we don't get to it at the beginning, we're going to just, you know,
yes.
It's going to be impossible.
You have a good point. At any rate, my suggestion was, and I think we should do this every podcast, is that we have a villain and or a hero of the week that each of us comes up with. Someone or some institution that has done something really crappy, or conversely, someone who really deserves accolades, generally speaking, in the political field, of course, because that's what we're talking about. So in keeping with that idea, my villain of the week is as follows. Last week, Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina announced that he would put a hold on all appointments made by President Obama. Not that he has any problem with the appointments, mind you, but because he wants even more hearings and even more testimony over the deadly attack at Benghazi, Libya last year. Of course, there have been numerous hearings already, and a review chaired by former Ambassador Thomas Pickering and former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Mike Mullen. Never minding the idea that Senate rules allow for such an outrageous action. Normally, such holds are over questions about a specific appointee or about something related to a particular appointee's prospective agency. Joining Senator Graham for Villain of the Week honors is the Republican caucus of the Senate. Today, they blocked a judicial appointment and also the nominee to head the agency that oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Why did they block the judicial appointment? Because that appellate court is now evenly split between Democratic appointees and Republican appointees, and they don't feel the need to give the Democrats a majority, and they claim there's not enough of a workload, even though it is the district court, circuit court rather, in Washington, D.C., which handles a very large number of very important cases. So together, these two actions are my villain of the week.
All right, very nice. Doug, do you want to comment on that? Do you have a villain you want to throw in the mix?
Well, I had not scoured through the websites to look for one. I think, playing off of what David was talking about, I think the villain of possibly the last couple of decades has been this concept in the U.S. Senate that it takes 60 votes to bring things up, and that one senator can stop the whole process. I think on this judicial appointment, there was some consideration by the Democrats to say, the heck with this rule, and we're going to go ahead and vote on these nominees, and we're not going to allow the 60-vote rule to stop the president from being able to appoint members of the judiciary.
Doug's exactly right that the filibuster rule is the villain of the last 20 years or more, probably. And what he's talking about is changing the rules so that you don't need 60 votes. That's called a nuclear option, and there's pros and cons about it. Even some Democrats are nervous about it. I frankly kind of hope that they do it, because the idea that you need 60 votes for virtually everything in the Senate is an absolute insanity. It didn't used to be that way, by the way. The Republicans and the Democrats, when they would filibuster, it used to be quite rare, maybe two or three a year over very major things. The Republicans under Obama have had something like 450 to 500 filibusters, which is, I don't know the numbers for sure, something on the order of as many or more as all the filibusters in the history of the Senate combined up until Obama's election as president. So that kind of tells you what we're up against.
Well, if I had to nominate a villain of the week, probably every week for me, it's going to be the Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. The thing that raised my ire the most in the last week that he did was the United Nations climate chief, Cristiano Figueres, had mentioned that we have this particularly bad forest fire raging through New South Wales. It's been going now for the last couple of weeks. And she mentioned that it was probably linked to climate change. And our esteemed Prime Minister went on a particularly annoying talk show, radio talk show, and said that she was talking through her hat, didn't know what she was talking about. Now, Cristina Figueres has a long and distinguished career, certainly more long and distinguished than Tony Abbott's. And, if I had to pick somebody who had one, if I had to pick one of them that, probably knows a thing or two about climate change, I know which one I'd be picking. But that kind of dismissal of the United Nations climate chief to say she is talking through her hat, it was just disgraceful. I mean, he couldn't even, it would have been a different thing if he had said, well, look, she might have a point there, and, we should look into what connection there is between Australia getting hotter and drier and increase in the severity of forest fires. But he just dismissed her outright, which I just think is... It probably says a lot about his attitude towards women and towards science and towards criticism.
Sounds like he's a clone of Stephen Harper, the prime minister, conservative prime minister here in Canada as well. He's told the scientists that they cannot speak freely on their findings, particularly if they disagree with the official government policy that the tar sands and other operations for energy are not polluting. That's the official government position. And anyone who's actively, criticizing Canada's environmental policies obviously is an outside agitator, a term I haven't heard since the years of the Nixon administration and Spiro Agnew talking about outside agitators. But we're getting the same thing here, my friend. Maybe there's something about the parliamentary system. I don't know.
Or in North Carolina, the North Carolina legislature recently voted to exclude any discussion of climate change in their planning process. So it's now not legal, theoretically, to discuss climate change as governments, local governments, cities in North Carolina consider their planning process.
Amazing.
Well, you just reminded me, Doug, when you talked about North Carolina, have you guys watched the video of that 12-year-old girl from North Carolina, Madison Kimray?
No.
No?
I guess I've missed that.
Oh, my goodness. You have to check this out. I won't go into detail. It was all over the web yesterday. Madison Kimray, she's a 12-year-old girl who got up at a political rally and gave a very, very inspiring speech. I won't go into any more details, but yeah, she's definitely my hero of the week. I was so impressed with her intelligence and her ability to articulate a concise political argument that maybe there is hope for the world after all. All right, now
now that you mention it, I thought we were talking about climate change, but she was talking about the voter identification process, trying to exclude people the right to vote, I believe, right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No. She's a real hero. I second your nomination.
Terrific.
I would go along with that, too.
All right, so we don't have a lot of time on today's show, so let's move on, and I would like to pick it up from where we left off last week. And, the idea that I had last week was that rather than just talk about contemporary events and what's going on in the world, we should dial it back a couple of steps and talk about how our political views evolve. But are they based on ethics or are they based on some other things? And we talked a little bit about ethics last week, and I'd like to kick it off again today, maybe starting with you, Doug, as out of the three of us, you've had a very long and esteemed career in politics, whereas, you know, David and I are mostly just agitators. Can you tell us, Doug, where's the core of your political beliefs come from? What are they based on? If you had to strip it all away, what's at the center of your political views?
Well, it's a good question. I've been thinking about it since you raised the issue, and it's a kind of a mystery. And my quickest answer is I'm not so sure. I can talk about some of the events, like the Vietnam War or Earth Day, that got me actively considering political issues. But what made me think the Vietnam War was a bad thing, and therefore part of my ethics or part of my principles were that I thought it was that we made a mistake? Or what made me be such a strong supporter of Earth Day and environmental issues? I was trained as a scientist, so I understand science. But again, that's more of a factual issue than an ethical issue. I grew up in a family where we didn't talk about politics. My parents were both sort of Democrats, I think, but I don't remember discussing who to vote for or going to vote. So to me, it's a bit of a mystery. And maybe as we explore this and we talk among ourselves, I'll have some more revelations about what caused me to have the ethical principles I do. It's kind of a mystery.
All right, well, that's fascinating and a little bit scary. David, what about your political views? Can you trace back the basis of them? What, you know, where it all started?
Well, I think first of all, I can sympathize with Doug completely, because it's not always easy to summarize the fundamental core of your beliefs, and we tend to, as I will hear in a moment, think more in terms of specific issues rather than some kind of underlying core. But you asked, you know, where did it all come from? And I think to a large extent, this is true with most people. We start out politically as typically most people as clones of our parents, or if not clones, certainly we get an awful lot of our basic political values as we get other values, you know, from our parents. And sometimes we rebel, as I've seen, you know, in families where the parents are very, very conservative and the kid turns out to be quite liberal or progressive. And I suppose the other way around is possible too, although I've not directly experienced that. In my case, my father was a professor of journalism, and my mother was, for the most part, a stay-at-home wife, but she also had degrees and was, you know, very active intellectually in terms of political discussions and beliefs. And that's where a lot of my stuff came from. And even though they were from Texas, which we don't think of as a liberal bastion, they came from Austin, Texas, which is even today fairly progressive. And in those days, even Texas put out some pretty decent politicians from time to time who did some awfully good things. Lyndon Johnson comes to mind for domestic policies. And Richards, much later, comes to mind, and so on, Jim Hightower. But sort of coming out of that, and to use a more modern phrase, I guess, I expect my politics and the politics of anyone that I want to support to be, in the words, I believe, of it was either Bush or Cheney, I don't remember which now, who complained about somebody being too reality-based. Well, you know, I want politicians, I want my leaders, I want my society, my civilization, to be reality-based, to make decisions, to take policy positions based on objective, secular analysis of whatever the issue might be, and this is especially true, obviously, with climate change and so on, and then make their decisions based on at least a reasonable perception of reality. Now, when a candidate presents him or herself to me, that's sort of the first overreaching thing I look at. But then I have a series, and I'm sure Doug does too, and you do, and so I'll start off this segment in a sense, but I have a series of issues, top issue priorities that sort of fit under this overall, I want them to be reality-based in their analysis. And sort of in order, although if you ask me next week, they might change in order slightly because they're all very important to me. The first issue that I look at for any candidate is what is their position on the environment and on population issues? Is it reality-based? Is it analytical? Or is it, you know, religious, you know, go forth and multiply kind of things?
David, let me sort of interrupt before you go. This is interesting, but pardon me, but it sort of begs the question. You're talking about analysis issues, and what we're supposed to be trying to deal with, and I was having trouble, is what led you to those principles, those ethics? Why is it that you think the environment is an important issue? Well, as your childhood, did you play in the garden and you loved the flowers? You know, why do you have those ethics? Not so much how do you apply them?
Because I'm reality based.
Let me add to that. Why do you believe that looking after the environment is a good thing as opposed to a bad thing? And say, you know, why do you believe that looking after the environment is more important than mining the crap out of the environment as fast as possible and getting or you know, manufacturing as much as we like and polluting the environment to, you know, increase our economic output? Why do you believe one thing is better than the other?
Well, because I'm reality-based. Again, it all boils down to that. And maybe you don't want this to happen, but assuming that we want civilization to survive, assuming that we want humanity to survive, there are some certain core things that we have to be concerned with. And environmental and population issues are really fundamental to the survival of our society. And I'm going to get into to other aspects of that. And it doesn't mean that I'm opposed, for example, to all mining. To the contrary, the things that we have come to want as a society, technologically and otherwise, depend on mining. Energy, maybe somewhat less so, because there are alternatives to that. But if we want to have cell phones and so on,
yeah, okay. There's going to be
trade-offs. But
let's
but
get back the, to the bottom. Point.
Well, I am on the point.
Well, no, you're talking about mining and cell phones. Let's get back to why you believe in that one thing is good and another thing is bad.
Ultimately,
what David is saying, and I've been thinking about how I answered, and I think my answer is sort of like his, and that is I, for some reason, in my genes or my education, am sort of a logical person. I try to look at the facts and see where they're going. So in the case of the Vietnam War, which was one of the major issues that got me active, I looked at the facts, and I studied the history, and I saw that it didn't make any sense. It wasn't accomplishing any practical purpose. And the same with the environmental issues that David was talking about. He says reality-based. I'd say an analysis of the facts and where those facts take us. And it's pretty clear that if we exploit the environment without any careful concern, we're going to destroy it to the point that other plants and animals are going to be extinct, and our own lives are going to be harmed in the long run. Now, what makes me think in the long run rather than the short run? What makes me be a little less greedy than maybe the Koch brothers, so to speak? Those are some of the complicated questions that you're sort of trying to get us to talk about, and it's difficult.
Well, but I am trying to talk about it. Let me try a little bit different tact, because your comment about the Koch brothers is right on target, and Cameron's question about why not mine the hell out of everything, and you also mentioned, Doug, the long term. I as I just said, I want the society, I want human civilization to survive, and the only way I, based on my analysis of reality, the only way I see that happening is for very significant progress to be made on environmental and population issues. And then as a subset to that, the next logical question is, okay, let's assume that we want to take the actions that allow human civilization to survive. And then there'll be some disagreements over what we need to do and don't need to do. But let's assume that we all agree on that. Then I look at, okay, how do I want civilization to be? What kind of qualities do I want our civilization to have? And so then I look at prospective politicians or policy statements of whatever kind, at things, for example, like women and gay rights issues, particularly abortion rights. It would be the ability of, I want women to have the ability to control their bodies. I want gays to have the ability to, you know, to have the relationships that they choose without discrimination and burdens. Economic equalities, things like the safety net, fair taxes, et cetera. Good access, equal access to education and health care. Infrastructure spending, including things like the stimulus, which provides union jobs, so economic and social development and environmental concerns, and then mass transit and water programs for infrastructure, and then also consumer regulations like banking and safety regulations, other things that we depend on in our society. And so, but basically, when I look at a candidate, I look at how they are on these, and I sort of boil it down. I wanted to be liberal, progressive, call what you want, female if at all possible, because we need more women in politics. I wanted to be honest, and fundamentally, I want them to be an environmentalist, because to me, the environment less population nixes everything.
And those are all things that I understand and sort of agree with your analysis of how you decide that. But why did David Markham turn out to be a person that thinks higher taxes and using money for food stamps is better than having more money for David and making people pull themselves about their bootstraps? There's a whole other philosophy out there that disagrees with you completely. And why did you come down on the that ethical side of things, that food stamps and infrastructure is a good thing, rather than small government and cutting taxes is a good thing? Where did you come up with that ethical system?
Well, again, as I suggested, fundamentally, I came up with that because that was the way my parents were, but also my college experience, courses that I took, people that I had debates with during my university years, that certainly impacted, my outlook on things. My skepticism of wars is based to a large extent, I suspect, on the fact that I am a veteran of Vietnam. I served my country, and I'm very proud that I served my country, but I wish to hell I could have served it, in a better endeavor than the Vietnam War, which I agree with you, Doug, and I suspect Cameron, that it was a horrible mistake. The only bigger mistake we've made was Bush's invasion of Iraq, which I think was actually worse. But as I grew up, including my university years and even in my early 20s when I was in Vietnam, these are the kinds of things that I begin to develop. And then after that, it's people I've associated with, including people like Cameron, who he and I have had some political discussions. We don't always agree, but he has good ideas. You, Doug, have been a friend of mine since 1973 or 74, and we've had lots of political discussions, and I've learned a lot about environmental issues, for example, from you. And again, you and I don't always agree, but we have tended to play off of each other politically, And I think we've each had influence on the other's approach to some political issues. My ex-wife Barbara and I used to have political discussions. Ed and I have discussions. I've had discussions with countless people. And okay. That's how it is. There's so, no one so thing. But my point is there's no one thing you can point to.
Well, look, I mean, I tell you why I'm interested in this. I mean, apart from the obvious reason. I grew up in a family that was, well, at least with my parents, as far as I could tell, were completely apolitical. Politics was never discussed. In fact, I grew up being told that you should never discuss sex, politics, or religion around the dinner table. Of course, you know, as I now say, well, what else is there to talk about, quite frankly? They're the only things worth talking about. Those things in Napoleon, really, are the only things worth talking about.
There you go. So you better add the emperor in there.
Yeah. And then in my 20s, my early 20s, when I was sort of 18, I met a guy who told me that I needed to invest 10% of my income in my brain for the rest of my life. And it was good advice. So I started reading nonfiction, you know, politics, history. That's when I got interested in Napoleon. But I started reading a lot of different stuff voraciously. And it led to me initially becoming extremely conservative politically. In my 20s, I was extremely conservative. I read everything from Ayn Rand to Milton Friedman to Nixon's memoirs, Kissinger, Australian politicians on the right and economists. I was extremely right in my politics. But then I made a mistake. I didn't stop reading. I kept reading. And I read Chomsky, and I read I read Marx and Engels, and I read everything I could get on the other side of politics as well. And I find when I get into political discussions with people often, I say, well, tell me who you've read. What have you read? And I find that people, I'm talking about the general public here, have usually not read any political literature, or if they have, they've usually read one perspective. They've read, you know, a bunch of stuff from the right, or they've read a bunch of stuff from the left. But very rarely do I meet people who try and read 20 books from opposing camps and then try and make up their own mind about, well, what kind of world do I want to live in? So I'm just interested in hearing how other people, I know how I came to my current political beliefs, but I'm fascinated to hear how you guys have articulated your story.
Well, that reminds me, and listening to David a minute ago and now listening to you reminds me of a thought. I read an article some time ago, and I couldn't find it now if I wanted to, I don't think. But we could probably do a Google. And this article said that they had done a survey, and they found that liberal people generally had higher IQs than conservative people. And, of course, as a liberal person, I thought that was really a good thing. But assuming that has some validity, that leads me to maybe another analysis of where I came to my political and ethical views. And that would be, I'm a fairly intelligent person. I've got a high IQ, etc. Became a member of Men's at one time, just for the hell of it. But anyway, the point being, if you're a fairly intelligent person, and then you read, and you talk to other people, and you discuss, and you debate. And I'm thinking now to my college and my graduate work when I went to Stanford, and we would sit around and have these great political debates of philosophy and existentialism and Camus and Heidegger and all that. And if you're fairly intelligent and you expose yourself to ideas by reading and discussing, you, I think, will come more likely to a liberal perspective. And I think that's probably how I got to mine, starting out as a fairly intelligent person and then absorbing ideas and thoughts and then beginning to see that they made sense in the liberal ethical perspective.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that, although I'm always a little bit nervous about saying that there's a relationship between intelligence and political philosophy. For one thing, some of the smartest people that I've been privileged to know in my life have been politically very conservative. I honestly think it's much more to do, though, with environment. And I'll give you an example. If you are raised in a very religious family, you are far more likely to be conservative politically than you are to be liberal politically. If you are raised in the Deep South, for example, especially if you're Anglo, if you're white, you are far more likely to be conservative than if you were raised, let's say, in Rhode Island or New York or California or the state of Washington and Oregon. So environment, and this also includes family environment, of course, but also just the environment of who you're around and what kind of news you are likely to be exposed to. Never mind if you're just a Fox aficionado or something, but just in the general media, if you live in a small town in Alabama, the media is much more likely to be conservative than if you live in a small town in Northern California, let's say. Your environmental, your chance of birth, your chance of where you live has an enormous amount to do with how you develop your political philosophy as well. And I think we would be, hard pressed not to acknowledge the environmental impact on our political upbringing.
No, I agree. And to me, I can trace some of mine back to going to Stanford. And at
Absolutely.
Stanford, I met a lot of other, what I would say, very bright people who were thinking about things. And that was sort of an exposure that I got because of that environment. If I would not have gone to that school and spent that time there, my political views might be somewhat different. It's hard to say.
If you had gone to Brigham Young, I guarantee you, your views would have been different.
Right.
All right, gents. Well, that's a little over half an hour we've been recording. I feel like the discussion has been great. We can wrap it up here if you want, or we can keep going.
Well, I would think that, to me, that this is a somewhat perplexing topic in the sense that it's not 100% sure how people end up with their ethics. There are certain factors that we've identified, and I think both you and David have been very, very effective at talking about what you read, exposed to both sides of the issues, your family environment, your religious environment, the geographical environment that you grew up in, the kind of educational experiences you had. I think all those things are playing around with it. It might be fun to ask our listeners to chime in if that's appropriate, if they have some profound thoughts to add to this discussion, because I think it's kind of a mystery to a lot of people, and it was sort of a mystery to me until we talked more as to why I turned out to have the ethics that I guess I now have.
And I guess what I'm trying to get to at the core here is at some point in our lives, we have all decided that there are right and wrong modes of conduct. We decide that destroying the environment is bad, or we decide that destroying the environment in pursuit of profit is good. We decide that engaging in military conflicts for no particular reason is bad, or we decide that, well, we want to stop the spread of communism at any cost, because for some reason communism is inherently bad. And so we are happy to support wars in Vietnam, or we're happy to support, invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan because we believe that's a good thing to do. We're happy to support drone strikes on civilian targets in Pakistani border, and we're prepared to justify those things because we believe that it's good. Or we say, no, if you take innocent lives, that's an unacceptable cost, it's bad. At the heart of our political viewpoints, I think there is an ethical framework that we have developed, whether or not we're even completely consciously aware of it. that it exists, and I think that we should become consciously aware of it. We should drag these things out and question them from time to time ourselves and say, well, why do I believe that is right?
And I agree. And by the way, I caught your little, you know, quote unquote cheap shot about drones. Some would say that the ethical difference would be between those who understand that sometimes civilians get killed by accident in war, as opposed to those whose ethics say the whole point should be to deliberately kill civilians in war, as Al Qaeda and so on does. But the real point I want to make is, and I think you would all agree, but we need to make it clear, there's no sort of ending point to this. There's no sort of, okay, I've been through my childhood, I've been through my education, I've been through some years of politics or whatever. Now my ethics are fixed. These things change. People who supported the Vietnam War were outraged by the invasion of Iraq. Indeed, people who supported the first Iraq War defending Kuwait were outraged by the second Iraq War. You have people who are not just always opposed to war, but they want to know what is the point of this war or that war. And even our fundamental ethics change. Lots of people, I believe, because of the scientific discoveries and what's been in the media and so on, went from those who thought, well, in the long term, the environment will take care of itself, and if we can just begin to incrementally improve fuel efficiency and things like that, we'll be fine. And population is not a problem. There's plenty of room in the world for all of us. You know, but as time goes on and you begin to see this study and that study and this fact and that fact,
but
even at my advanced
David,
years,
studies,
I change my mind.
But David,
you know, I evolve.
But David, studies don't change your ethical perspective. You know, but you're right, though. I think maybe your ethical views do change. Certainly mine have over, you know, my adult life. But, you know, but whether or not we should go to war, or in a particular war, isn't really an ethical question. I think the ethical question is what are the acceptable reasons for us to engage in a military conflict? And, you know, those things may not necessarily change dramatically over time once you arrive at a certain position. But I don't think, and this is, you know, again, the reason for bringing this up, I don't think enough of us think through these key ethics deeply enough on a regular enough basis. And I don't think the media or our political leaders encourage us enough to think through the core ethics of why we're, you know, why this is the right policy.
I think you're right. And part of the reason they don't, if you want to be a little cynical, is that if they got us thinking about the ethics, we might be much more critical of their policies, so because some of their policies are not very ethical, in my opinion, and I think that a lot of people share that. I don't think we can leave without at least throwing in the fact that I believe, to some extent, and maybe to a large extent, the basic ethics of that we hold do come from a religious basis. I mean, it's kind of a trite to say it, but they're the Ten Commandments. You don't lie, you don't steal, you blah, blah, blah. And in other religions, there are similar sets of principles. Now, how those religions develop those principles, which they've sort of overlaid on society, I think those, quote, Ten Commandments sort of concepts are probably the basis for a lot of the ethics that all of us have.
Well,
I would not disagree with that, and I speak as a devout atheist who has grown to be extremely cynical toward religion, even though I was raised religiously and used to be very active in my church and in my youth, and at one time even considered being a Presbyterian minister, although that was quite brief. And you're right, certain religious principles do permeate our even our secular Western society. Now, the Ten Commandments is probably only a handful of them that we would truly say are fundamental to, you know, to ethics throughout our society.
Is the United States a secular society? Certainly doesn't seem to be from here.
It is and it isn't. You know, technically it is, without question. We do not have an establishment of religion of any kind. You know, we don't have Sharia law or the Ten Commandments law. You know, you can have graven images all you want to, and no one's going to throw you in jail, you know, and so on. But there is an underlying religious aspect to our society, but that's hardly unique. I mean, Western Europe, after all, underwent horrific religious wars over the centuries, and it still, has a basically a religious undertone to it, as most Western cultures do. Maybe not as much as
right, but again, without going on forever about that. There are religious battles in terms of power and structure and money. That's all part of the religious structure. But underneath that, there are things we keep saying, like you know, you should treat others like you'd like to be treated. Now, I heard that when I was a child. Now, is that religion? Well, not really. But in the Ten Commandments, you know, that thou shalt not steal, that thou shalt not kill. Those are not really religious as much as they are ethics, but they sort of come to us from a religious background. And I think that's true of other religions beyond Christianity, including the Islam and Judaism and Buddhism and Hinduism. I think all those religions, and I'm not a religious scholar, maybe we should invite a religious scholar to join us one of these talks, but I think, you know, do unto others as you would like to have them done unto you, etc. I think that is a big foundation of our ethic beliefs.
I agree,
and you know, I don't want to get caught into the roots of those ethics, you know, that predate certainly Judeo-Christianity. But here's what I think we should wrap up, and I would like to throw this homework out to the three of us and to any of our listeners who care to join us. I think a useful homework exercise is to sit down with a pen and a piece of paper at some stage over the next week and write down what are the key ethics that I believe in. And not necessarily where do they come from, because let's not worry about that right now, but what are the key ethical principles that I would like to strive towards, I want to adhere to, and therefore, you know, I want my elected representatives to represent these key ethical principles as well. I think that would, you know, kind of be enlightening to regroup with you guys next week and hear about what your key ethics are and see then how they are aligned to your political beliefs. Anyway, with that...
That should be a challenge.
I want to thank the two of you. Any last comments, Doug, before we wrap up?
Nope, just wish everyone a good week, and I would encourage our listeners to send us some thoughts, because this is a fairly deep subject.
It is. David, any last thoughts?
It's a very deep subject. We've had only one or two comments on our comment section on the website, and I find that, you know, unfortunate, because I think one of the reasons that I and Doug and Cameron are interested in doing this is because we have hopes that it will not just quote-unquote educate people, but also calls our listeners to sort of think about these issues and maybe offer their own perspectives as well. But I also have to say that we have to be a little careful to go too far overboard on the question of ethics. I mean, I know this is important to Cameron, it's important to all of us, but the fundamental political questions that we deal with tend to be on personalities and issues and very specific issues, and how those issues reflect what we want for our society, for our civilization. And it may not always be possible to really easily identify an ethic other than, like, for example, in the case of environmentalism, a desire for our society to survive. The ethic there would be, we want our society, we want human civilization to survive. Okay, how do we go about it? You know, we have a basic ethic of what, you know, we want our civilization to be a fair and just society. That's a good ethic. But then how do we determine how to produce a good and just society? So, you know, we have to look at ethics, but we also have to look, I think, at very specific issues as well. And I look forward to more of the same in the future.
Well, I think that, I mean, I fundamentally disagree with you. I think every policy can be broken down to can be broken down into right and wrong conduct, which is the study of ethics. In every policy, whether it's environment or asylum seekers or campaign contributions, at the end of the day, it takes work, but you can reduce it down to what is right and what is wrong, and why do we believe this is right and this is wrong?
No, I disagree. You can't, because there are some ethical issues that two sides can feel very, very strongly are the correct side, and from a sort of an analytical analysis, ethical analysis, they're right. Let me give you a very quick example, and this is one of the most difficult political issues in the world today. That's the question of abortion. If you have a set of ethics that says, you know, life is sacrosanct, if there's anything we should be protecting on this face of this earth, it's life, then you're with some possible exceptions, you are going to be likely the so-called pro-life or anti-choice point of view, because you want to protect life because you consider life to be sacrosanct. If your ethics say, I believe in the sanctity of a woman's ability to control her own destiny, to control her own body, her own reproduction, et cetera, then you are going to end up in the pro-choice camp. And both sets of ethics are going to seem extremely real and extremely valid, and they're both going to be grounded in other ethical elements, religious and otherwise, and that's why it's so hard for those two sides to ever compromise, because to them, their political position reflects a completely valid ethical position.
Well, but you've just proven my point. I mean, and I don't want to get sidetracked on you know, issues like abortion, because that, you know, that's obviously a very, very big subject. But again,
we'll be there again later, I know.
People's positions on that issue are based on their ethics, and so it requires us to examine what ethics we believe in and why we believe in them and try and find some common ground. Anyway, with that, I thank you again, both. I love talking to the two of you. It's always intelligent and vibrant and passionate. And that's,
as it is talking to you.
As it should be. Have a lovely Halloween, gentlemen. And David, enjoy your trip next week, your vacation, and we'll talk again in a week, or if not, in 2 weeks.
Sounds good. Good night.
Good night, guys.
Good night,
good morning.
Great discussion as always.
Bye-bye.
Bye.